From Michigan Public, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, one of the winners in Tuesday's Democratic primary talks about what kinds of change he plans to work on.
We need to build more cooperatives in our community for the first time in over 50 years. And we need to build public land trusts.
It's a conversation with Youssef Rabi about new times in Ann Arbor. Also, the writer Aaron Robertson joins us to discuss his fascination with the struggles of Black Catholics in Detroit during the 70s, 80s, and 90s.
I could sense people's anger turning into energy. Growing up in a Black family, I didn't really see white people doing it like this. So it was like, these white people are mad and they're gonna do something about this injustice.
We'll be listening to an extended excerpt from his podcast series, The City and the Cross. All that coming up today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. This hour on the show, we're going to speak with author Aaron Robertson about his new history of Black Catholics in Detroit.
He goes so far as to call it a form of cultural genocide. That was a word that was used not only to describe the closings of churches, but also the closures of Black Catholic schools.
That story's coming up in just a bit, but first, Ann Arbor has elected the person we believe to be the new mayor. Youssef Rabi unseated incumbent Christopher Taylor, who has served as mayor in Ann Arbor for 12 years and served in city government for 18 overall. Now, because Ann Arbor tends to vote so strongly Democratic in elections, it's common for the Democratic primary essentially to choose winners. So in this case, Youssef Rabi, Democratic socialist who is a county commissioner and a former state legislator, is the guy. He joins us in studio today. Youssef Rabi, welcome to Stateside and congratulations.
Thank you so much. I'm very excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
This is a certain kind of level up for you in terms of your government work. A lot of your prior experience has been in a legislative setting. Obviously, administrating is different. How have you been preparing to run a mid-sized city bureaucracy?
Well, a few things. First of all, Ann Arbor is what's called a weak mayor system, meaning I am still going to have an administrator and an entire team of administrative staff that are going to help run the organization. And of course, there is an entire city council that I will have to work with. It's going to be a little bit of both, a little bit of administering, a little bit of legislating. And one of the things that I feel very prepared for in terms of this role is being in a leadership role. Because when I was in the state legislature, I did serve as the Democratic floor leader. When I was a county commissioner, I did serve as chair of the board, and this role is sort of a combination of some of those things with many new features as well.
You and incumbent Mayor Taylor both agreed that affordable housing is a huge problem, maybe the huge problem in the city right now, but you differed on how to get to a more affordable place. Can you lay out your vision for us?
Absolutely. So one of the big reasons I decided to run was because of how unaffordable Ann Arbor has become. I grew up in this community. I love Ann Arbor with everything that I have. And it is really heartbreaking to me to see the people that make Ann Arbor what it is, the teachers, the parapros, the office professionals, the people that work at our city water treatment plant, that mow our lawns at the parks, that drive our buses. They can't afford to live here. My approach to solutions is that I believe that we need to double down on and invest heavily in creating publicly owned, permanently affordable housing. We have a wonderful Ann Arbor Housing Commission. We need to supercharge the work that they're doing. We need to build more cooperatives in our community for the first time in over 50 years. And we need to build public land trusts to help build homes that people can buy and build equity in, but that stay affordable over time.
Anyone who has even a glancing familiarity with publicly administered, publicly funded housing knows that it doesn't exactly pay for itself. What is the plan for financing something of this magnitude?
I don't want to raise property taxes on our residents to pay for this housing. So some of the housing that I'm proposing to build is going to be housing closer to the market rate, likely still more affordable than the market, but closer to market rate. The revenue from those units will then help to offset and subsidize the units that have to be more subsidized. So it is about creating, sort of a self-sufficient enterprise that will generate revenue and offset that generation of revenue with investments in creating more housing for the community.
One of the other giant-sized issues in this election was Ann Arbor's reliance on DTE mm-hmm. for its power. And a lot of folks who may have followed this even a little bit know that there's a strong campaign in Ann Arbor to take the city to a muni system. And a proposal for a city takeover of the power grid has now qualified for the ballot in November. You obviously were very much in favor of it. I'm curious about how residents can be sure that this is a better solution. There are people listening to us right now who have their own muni power systems in Lansing who know that they can be quite fallible.
They are. And I think so. Here's what I would start by saying. First and foremost, we are dealing with a fossil fuel for-profit company that has been taking advantage of our community for decades. They are never going to transition to 100% renewable energy. We will never meet our renewable energy goals with DTE as our provider. They are charging exorbitant rates. Every year they come back with a new rate increase. They are gouging the people of Ann Arbor and, frankly, the people of all of Southeast Michigan. So we need to move away from them from an affordability perspective and also from a reliability perspective. I have had my power go out way too many times, and I think that story is shared by many residents in Ann Arbor.
6 outages at my house this year so far.
There you go. And for, you know, one of the most heartbreaking stories I heard on the campaign trail was one of my canvassers was out knocking on a day that the power was out, and they encountered an elderly woman who was stuck in her recliner bed in the upright position because she couldn't move the bed because the power was out. And there's people who have medicine that's going bad. There are so many heartbreaking stories of why power reliability is important. And, you know, when we move to a municipal power system, which I hope we will, I fully support that effort. Not only will there be, if you look across the state at other municipal systems, we see they are greener, they are cheaper, and more reliable. What I do want to emphasize, though, too, is that, like you said, not every municipal system is perfect, just like DTE is not perfect. But the main difference is that with the municipal system, you have public accountability, which you don't have with DTE. In a place, I always give this example because I think it's really important. In Lansing, which my wife is from Lansing originally. My father-in-law lived in East Lansing for a long time. And when there was that big power outage in 2013, which, you know, took down, you know, the grid for all of, you know, Lansing Board of Water and Light, or a big chunk of it, it was a disaster. And there were days and days and days that went on without power being restored. And what happened is the public in their, you know, homes were, you know, lighting their torches and sharpening their pitchforks and marched down to City Hall and told their elected officials how mad they were that the grid had gone down. And since then, Lansing Board of Water and Light has stepped up to the plate and has made sure that their system is a lot more reliable, and they have fixed, you know, their infrastructure. So that public accountability is really important, and it's something that we just don't have with DTE. The Michigan Public Service Commission is essentially a joke when it comes to enforcing standards around our for-profit utilities. The last thing I'll say on this too is, when you look at the inefficiency of these private monopoly utilities like DT and consumers, I say inefficiency very intentionally because they are taking money for profits. That is an inefficiency. They are taking money for CEO pay. That is an inefficiency. They are taking money for lobbying the legislature and executives and the MPSC. They are taking that money out of our pockets to do those things. Those are inefficiencies. If we create a municipal system, we save those dollars that would have otherwise been going to those things, and we put them back in creating grid reliability or reducing costs.
Ann Arbor has never exactly lacked for party alignment. It's pretty common to see all Democrats sitting in those chairs at City Hall through all those 6-hour, 8-hour plus meetings. You know, there is dissent and there is a lot of public feedback on how various people who have the same party name are interpreting what should be going on in the city. In a sense, it is divided government, as you say, because there are people with varying degrees of experience and a lot of newcomers. How do you see your way through this dynamic?
The same way that I've seen my way through 16 years of that similar dynamic. I've never served on a body where everybody is of the same mind. I think that there's always opportunity for agreement. I see everybody as being, on a political spectrum on every issue. And for me, it's important. And what served me well is to separate, personalities from policy. I think it's really important that we delve into the issues. And for each city council member, what I've been saying and sharing saying very clearly is like, I want you to be successful. As mayor, I see my role as a leader to help make sure that your priorities get done, because you have been elected by the people of our community to serve them. You made promises on the campaign trail, and I want to help you meet those. And I think that it's important that we, so let me say this too. I think this is important to put out there, which is Ann Arbor has become so factionalized, like you're saying. We are all Democrats for the most part, but there's become like these two factions. And what I said right off the bat when I decided to run in my opening announcement is I'm not on either side. I'm on the people's side. And I still hold true to that. I believe that these factions, these sides in Ann Arbor politics are toxic and destructive to our political discourse, because what they ultimately create is a reinforcement of the tribalism that exists at the federal and state level. We can't have tribalism when we're trying to solve political issues. What I would like to try to do is to break down those barriers and to reach, quote unquote, across the aisle, to try to break that aisle down so that we are realizing that everybody in Ann Arbor is on the same team, that we have, shared goals, and that while we may disagree on some of those issues, that's fine. That's how democracy works. We're supposed to disagree, but let's not make it personal. Let's not make it like, I'm not going to talk to that person because they're on that side. It shouldn't be about that. It should be about how do we focus on the issues and disagree respectfully. And I hope to bring that to city council as well. As I've said on the campaign trail, I don't want a council that's unanimous. I don't want a council that rubber stamps. I want a council that is iterative, that debates, that has dialogue, that offers amendments. And I'm not always going to get my way, and I don't want to always get my way. I've never always gotten my way. I think it's important to have that public discourse and that process because I believe in the institution of democracy, and ultimately that's what's at stake here.
Yousef Rabi just won the Democratic primary to be a candidate in November as mayor of Ann Arbor. We think it very likely he's going to be winning that race. Yousef Rabi, thank you for your time.
It's a pleasure being here. Thank you for having me.
We need to break for just a minute now. After that, translator and author Aaron. We reached out to DTE for a response to this conversation, and here's what they had to say. Quoting here, the proposal to take over Ann Arbor's electric grid will cost the city of Ann Arbor nearly $1 billion on day one, leading to skyrocketing costs for Ann Arbor businesses and residents. Last year, DTE delivered the best electric reliability Ann Arbor has experienced in nearly 30 years. It's proof that DTE's five-year, $270 million plan to modernize Ann Arbor's electric system is working. We will remain focused on our work, and we'll continue to deliver the reliable, affordable clean energy future Ann Arbor deserves. We need to break for just a minute now. After that, translator and author Aaron Robertson talks about his new history of Black resistance among Black Catholics in Detroit during a time of consolidation. Stay with us. This is Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Writer and translator Aaron Robertson has frequently written about Black Detroiters constructing new realities for their lives as societal structures crumble or fail them outright. His work has taken him into the rich history of the Shrine of the Black Madonna and his family's own story. His latest work is a podcast that was produced for the magazine Commonweal, telling stories from Detroit's Black Catholic congregations, places like St. Benedict, Sacred Heart, St. Cecilia, St. Agnes, and other historically Black parishes that shaped and were shaped by their times. We've invited him to talk to us about the series today. Aaron Robertson, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you so much, April.
You wrote a book in 2024 that was called The Black Utopians, and it was about the Reverend Albert Clegg, founder of the Shrine of the Black Madonna, who shaped this Black Christian nationalist movement that was very influential in Detroit. And the book touched very briefly on what this podcast explores, a speech that Clegg gave to a gathering of Black Catholic priests. When you were doing the research for Black Utopians, did you just put a pin in that piece and decide that you were going to need to revisit this meeting later?
That is exactly what I did. Reverend Clegg Jr., who was really the focus of my first book, The Black Utopians, he was a Protestant minister in Detroit In 1968, a couple of weeks after Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated, he was the keynote speaker at a gathering that happened here in Detroit called the National Black Catholic Clergy Caucus. And that was a really important event in the history of the American Catholic Church and Black Catholicism in general, because a group of priests, about 60 priests from around the country, gathered to essentially demand recognition from the Catholic Church. And a part of their criticisms was that the church was, quote, primarily a white racist institution. This gathering is often considered the sort of symbolic start of what is sometimes called the Black Catholic movement. So, you know, I did not grow up Catholic myself. I grew up Baptist. I now identify as agnostic. But because I have been so interested in African-American religious histories in Detroit, I felt that there was a bigger story to explore here. So I did want to return to it at some point.
What you lay out in the podcast are just a whole slew of forces that Black Catholics in Detroit were up against. Can I ask, as you were talking with your sources, what kind of things did they tell you about why they chose the faith?
Gosh, well, what was interesting is that so many of the people I spoke to were born in Catholic families. There were some people whose families had come from places like New Orleans and had eventually moved up north as a part of the Great Migration. You know, of course, New Orleans is one of the country's real centers of Black Catholicism. In some cases, there were stories of conversion. A Catholic husband or wife who married, let's say, a Baptist because of love or because of a desire to, you know, send their kids to Catholic schools, the non-Catholic spouse would sometimes convert and raise the child Catholic. But a part of my interest in the story was to really understand, as a non-Catholic, what specifically would draw Black Americans to a church that historically, you know, had not really made room for them, frankly. And just a little more than a month ago, the Pope issued his first encyclical where he apologizes on behalf of the Vatican for the role that the Catholic Church played in the slave trade. So, you know, I wanted to understand what was it about the faith that drew people. And one of the other common answers was just community. These Black Catholic churches were so often where people had their most meaningful bonds with friends, with family. And I think, you know, sometimes it is as simple as that. The people that make you feel loved and comforted in the world.
The services that people told you about attending at St. Agnes or Our Lady of Victory, what would you say made them different?
Well, one of the topics I love to talk about with Catholics here, with Black Catholics, is the way that, you know, beginning in the 60s and especially, you know, throughout the 1970s, there was a concerted effort on the part of Black Catholics to enculturate the Mass. So what that means really is bringing unique, sort of authentic Black American cultural experiences to the church. That meant bringing in the influence of things like gospel and jazz into liturgical music. We have to also remember that in the early 1960s, the Catholic Church worldwide was changing because of Vatican II, the Second Vatican Council, which was really an attempt to modernize the Catholic Church. You know, it marked the beginning of masses in English. You know, the priest, instead of facing away from the congregation, looked towards them. And so the you know, Black Catholic masses have always been a really interesting wedding of some of the traditional, you know, Catholic chant and polyphony, for example, mm-hmm. with other cultural expressions. And that, I think, is what makes it like such a unique tradition.
For sure. there were problems over time with issues like, you know, just how many black priests would be ordained and how many lay people would be designated as lay people to take leadership roles in their congregation. But things really start coming to a head with the consolidation that was going on in the 70s and the 80s. What made it so particularly painful for the parishioners that you spoke with?
Gosh, yeah. So, you know, I was drawn to this story because in some ways, Detroit was one of the radical hubs of the Black Catholic movement. But decades later, by the late 80s, because of white flight, because, you know, these big Catholic churches in Detroit were experiencing dwindling congregations and they had less money, the archdiocese decided that it would be best for the church if these buildings were consolidated and enclosed. You know, it was a matter, the archdiocese would say, of conserving resources or really channeling them where the church had a larger presence. So that meant moving resources away from the city to the suburbs.
You had some amazing sourcing in here. A man spoke with you who was chief of staff to Cardinal Xhaka at the time, Walter Hurley. Do you know, is this the first time he's spoken publicly since he left that job?
That's a great question.
He was very frank.
He was. I can't say with 100% certainty that this was the first time, you know, he spoke about that period. But, you know, Walter Hurley was really the man who was in charge of implementing the closures that Cardinal Edmund Xhaka had called for. I did not necessarily know whether the people who had been a part of that process would express regret for how it unfolded or not. There was this sense by the Archdiocese then, and to some extent now, that consolidation, as painful as it might be for the Catholics who experience it, you know, church closures, church mergers, it is ultimately for the good of the universal church. The Catholics who experienced these closures would say otherwise. They would say that to close a church, and particularly a Black Catholic church, is a kind of sin, actually. It takes away needed resources, not only from the Catholic community that is being affected, but from the community that is around these churches.
They were the ones who stayed in Detroit.
Yes, exactly. But it was also, you know, known as the single largest instance of Catholic church closures that had ever happened in the U.S. at the time. Now, there would ultimately be a little more than 30 churches that were closed or merged. But that event became the blueprint for urban parish consolidations that would continue to happen throughout the Midwest and the Northeast. You know, since 1989, there have been mass church closings in places like Boston and Newark and Baltimore. And really what happened here in Detroit, what disproportionately affected Black Catholics in Detroit, became the model for what we see now.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is writer Aaron Robertson. He has a new podcast called The City and the Cross that talks about Black Catholic experiences in Detroit at a time of consolidation. Aaron, in this podcast, it's really comprehensive and the context is impressive. There was not any discussion of the history of clergy sex abuse in the Catholic Church. It felt like an intentional choice. Even though this is a pretty huge part of the church's modern history, and it's certainly part of the financial picture that was driving the closures within the past 20 years from when we're speaking right now, can you share your thinking about why you decided not to make it part of this story?
Yes. You know, people talk now about, you know, what is contributing to declining religious affiliation in general, how is that affecting the Catholic Church in particular?
And lots of Protestant congregations too.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, in conversations with some people for the podcast, with some Black Catholics, the huge effect of the clergy abuse scandal was mentioned, certainly. And I felt that, you know, that it's such a huge topic that I didn't want to only mention it like briefly, really. You know, it feels like another project, honestly. I think because of how much it drove many Catholics away from the church. I was interested in, with this podcast in particular, in thinking about who has the right to decide or declare what is sacred. You know, who has the right to decide what a church is and what kinds of communities are worth keeping open. What's interesting about the Catholic Church to me is, because it is hierarchical and because the Archbishop is really the one who decides whether a church closes or remains open. What that leads to is, in this case, a sense by parishioners that if their church closes, it's almost like this place that they had invested so much time in, so much energy, and so many resources in, is stripped away from them. And I felt that, you know, that was particularly interesting to think about as it relates to race, right? I mean, Black Catholics have worked so hard and for so long to carve out spaces for themselves within this institutional church. And so to take these places away, that was experienced as a kind of betrayal, really. One person in the podcast even described, he goes so far as to call it a form of cultural genocide. That was a word that was used not only to describe the closings of churches, but also the closures of Black Catholic schools, which was happening largely in the late 1960s and 1970s as well. So,
the final episode of the podcast notes that the story is still happening, and consolidation is like there are people who've maybe seen their churches close, you know, have been to one church that closed, and then the church that they went to after that was closed too, and now the church they're going to is perhaps not safe. Do you have a sense of where some of the parishioners who peeled off, where they ended up? There was one priest named John McKenzie who I think went to an Orthodox church?
Yes.
Wow.
A kind of Eastern Orthodox church, yeah.
For reasons that are very specific to him. But what else do people tell you about that void in their life?
Well, this is very interesting. So, you know, I moved back to Detroit from New York last fall, in part to work on this project, you know, and I thought that I was coming back to focus on the events of 1989 mostly, but beginning in 2025, the Archdiocese of Detroit, you know, has started another restructuring process, and what that means is, you know, like over the course of the next 2 years, the Archdiocese of Detroit will most likely be closing and merging more churches. This will not only affect the city of Detroit, but it will affect the suburbs as well. So when I learned that this process was happening again, immediately I wondered about the people who had lived through 1989, the Black Catholics who had been, in churches that closed and merged. I wanted to know not only how they were feeling about this this current process, but like what they wanted the Archdiocese to know about their experiences. There are some Catholics decide to give merger is a chance, right? Mm-hmm. So they try to become a part of a new church community, but that is not without complications. You know, it's not just like you walk into another building and are immediately integrated into another spiritual community.
Well, I mean, it's got to be said, a lot of these people may be walking into largely white parishes.
That's right.
Not yeah. always, but
yeah, and so it you know, it's like you're the new kid who is, you know, transferring from one school to another. it's not easy, right? But there are also Black Catholics, and I found this to be particularly true among older Black Catholics, you know, people in their 70s, 80s, who have seen this process unfold and have said that if my church closes or if there's a merger, I'm not going to go back to church again, you know, because I've experienced this heartbreak already, and I'm tired and I don't want to go through it again. So that is something that I'm not sure that archdiocesan leadership entirely recognizes or appreciates, that just because you consolidate churches and hope that people will migrate to the places that remain open, humans are much more complex and emotional than a rationalized process.
Aaron Robertson produced and wrote the podcast The City and the Cross, a production for Commonweal magazine. It's in three parts. You can find it at the Commonweal website or wherever you listen to fine podcasts. Aaron Robertson, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, April. I appreciate it.
We're going to listen to an excerpt from The City and the Cross right after we take a short break.
I don't know if Father Thomas was just doing a mental exercise, but he was calculating off the top of his head what the capacity of the church was. Maybe he was gearing up to answer some of the media questions about how many people were there. I think he came up with a number like 800, and that would have been in the balcony too.
Back in just a moment. You're with Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. We've been talking with native Detroiter, writer and translator Aaron Robertson. His new podcast series, The City and the Cross, is a three-part series that spans Black Catholic life in Detroit from the early 20th century till today. Robertson told us that he finds this period illuminates a form of Black resistance that's not often retold in histories of the city. In 1989, the Detroit Archdiocese, under the direction of Cardinal Edmund Shaka, consolidated and closed dozens of churches, including several parishes that were very important to Black Catholics. We'd like to bring you an extended excerpt from the podcast, the second episode, titled A Padlock on All the Doors.
Beautiful works of art, magnificent stained glass windows, altars that sparkle with silver and gold. Ceilings touching the sky. The traditions of the Catholic Church have always included ornate places of worship, places befitting God. But the times are different. Built years ago, Detroit's Catholic churches have fallen victim to the departure of parishioners from the city, resulting in the closing of 31 Catholic churches by June 30th of this year and leaving another 25 churches. Only a one-year time to fight for survival. The main reason, economics. The hard reality, change. Perhaps none of the churches would have to close if more people attended services. But today, small congregations just can't finance the kind of costs the church generates. The doors will close forever, with only relics of the pageantry remaining. It's a painful fact that Detroit-era Catholics are being forced to accept. Or do they?
From Commonweal, this is The City and the Cross. I'm Aaron Robertson. Part 2, A Padlock on All the Doors. The clip you just heard is from 1989, a year that marked a turning point in the history of the American Catholic Church, its relationship to cities, and its relationship to Black Catholics in Detroit. But to understand what happened in 1989, we need to understand what happened in the years leading up to it. In 1982, Archbishop Edmund Shaka had just arrived in Detroit. He had a reputation for being a good businessman. He turned around the finances in his previous diocese. A group of city priests, members of the Detroit Catholic Pastoral Alliance, the DCPA, met with him to discuss how the church could have a stronger presence in the city. By then, Detroit was predominantly Black. Father Norm Thomas, the pastor at Sacred Heart Church, Detroit's so-called Black Catholic Cathedral, was one of the founding members of the DCPA. Here's Father Thomas speaking on the Kelly & Company morning show in Detroit.
We began in 1982 when the Cardinal came. Several of us priests met with him and suggested that a task force be formed in order to improve and strengthen the ministry of the church in the city. The task force recommended that parishes should be given at least a year to build up their resources in the church.
The Inner City Task Force was officially formed in 1983. Over the next few years, they developed criteria for what made a thriving parish community, what made it viable. Everything from church attendance to outreach to the poor. The work of the task force ended in 1986. By 1988, Cardinal Shaka had created two new committees to plan a reorganization of parishes in the city. These groups met to consider one basic question. What should be done about Catholic churches in Detroit that had smaller congregations and fewer resources than ever before? For these committees, the metrics that carried the most weight were financial. Parishes needed at least $100,000 in annual income and 500 households to survive. Neither of these groups consulted with the members of the original task force. The priests who'd started this process, who had hoped to make city churches stronger after decades of white Catholic flight to the suburbs, were no longer in the room.
I remember the Cardinal listening intently as to what was being said. One of the concerns was just not, are we going to close this, but how do we assure the presence of the church in this area?
Walter Hurley was Cardinal Shaka's chief of staff. He was there for these meetings about the future of city churches, taking the minutes.
So many of the parishes in the city were established as ethnic parishes. As people began to move out, they became smaller. They still had big structures and buildings that needed to be addressed. And there was no way that they could afford to do that. You had so many priests assigned to the city for such small groups of people. And you had huge suburban parishes that needed to be addressed as well.
The question of viability would be at the heart of an impassioned debate about the meaning and purpose of the church in a transforming city. What made a parish, a community, viable? Was it what a consulting firm hired by the archdiocese said it was? Could numbers on a spreadsheet ever account for the vitality of life that existed in small churches, even if there were only a few dozen or so people who showed up for Mass? These questions weren't yet resolved on September 28, 1988, when the Archdiocese made a closed-circuit TV announcement. Dozens of teleconferencing sites were set up across the Archdiocese. This would be the first time that parishioners in Detroit learned the fates of their churches. Patricia Montemuri was a reporter for the Detroit Free Press. She'd been covering the Catholic Church in Detroit since the late 1970s. The newsroom knew what was coming.
The Free Press took a bunch of staff people and freelancers to go to different parishes to the Mass on Saturday afternoon and report what was said. I just remember naively thinking that, oh, there's going to be so much outrage and all these former parishioners are going to rush back and they're going to support their old church and they're going to save them. That was fantasy. That just didn't happen.
The announcement itself was formal. The final recommendations Cardinal Shaka received from his advisory committees were staggering. 48 churches would close or merge. If all of these recommendations were accepted, almost half of the city's 112 Catholic churches would be gone. In the last months of 1988, parishes held hearings to appeal the recommendations. Some presented plans to meet the financial criteria. Others made the case that their parish served communities the church couldn't afford to abandon. In January 1989, Cardinal Sciacca announced his final decision. 32 parishes would close by June 30th, but 24 others were given a different designation.
The phrase questionably viable was pretty painful to hear.
Questionably viable. Technical language that couldn't capture what it meant to not know if your church, the physical anchor of your spiritual life, would survive.
It just sounded kind of clinical and insulting to a lot of people who put their heart and soul into maintaining the parish, having friends in the community, having it be a vital lifeline for so many. Cardinal Sciacca was nothing if not a really good businessman and accountant. He might not have done it with all the finesse and consideration it required, but he could see the problem, and he thought he was going to be among the first to tackle it, and a pioneer in downsizing.
The suburban Catholics Patricia had expected to come flooding back, people whose families had long since traded city life for neighborhoods farther out, largely stayed home. The resistance that did come was from the people who had never left, the congregation still worshiping in those city churches every Sunday. Walter Hurley says that's what slowed everything down.
There were a strongly motivated group in the city that fought to do everything they could to keep every parish open. They were very vocal about it, and they got a lot of publicity.
The news received national attention. This was shaping up to be the largest single closure of churches in the history of the U.S. Catholic Church at the time.
Among Detroit's Roman Catholics these days, there are a lot of questions and accusations. The charges center around a plan announced by the Archdiocese. And the question being asked is why? Why is the church doing this?
Decades of factory shutdowns and an exodus of the white middle class to the suburbs have left Detroit with a poor and predominantly black inner city and scores of near-empty churches.
Most of the parishes on the closing list are located in Detroit's most impoverished neighborhoods, raising fears the church is losing its concern for the poor.
The Archdiocese has promised increased support for social programs and parochial schools that now serve mostly non-Catholic blacks.
The Detroit Catholic Pastoral Alliance became the main organizing force of the resistance. It was led by Father Norm Thomas and Sister Jolene Van Handel, a Racine Dominican nun. One of the people they recruited was Kathy DeSantis. She'd been a nun for 14 years, teaching at an all-girls school in a wealthy suburb of Detroit. She'd resigned in protest after the principal blocked black students from transferring there. Not long after, she and a group of friends passed by Sacred Heart Church for the first time.
The guy who was driving, he said, "Anybody been to that church when we passed it?" I said, "No, what is it?" I hadn't even heard about it. He said, "I'm not sure, but a friend of mine goes here and he loves it. You want to go?" And everybody said, "Yeah, let's go." I was in that church for 5 minutes and I said, "Are they going to accept me? Because this is where I want to be."
Kathy started attending Sacred Heart regularly, trying to keep a low profile. She knew white people had a tendency to come in and take over. But Father Thomas noticed her anyway.
I get a phone call from Norm Thomas. I had been going to Sacred Heart, but I never introduced myself. I was trying to be very inconspicuous. When the phone call came, I thought I died and went to heaven. I couldn't believe it. They hired me because they needed an organizer. I said, "Norm, I've been a teacher. I've never done organizing in my life." He said, "You'll learn. Sister Jolene says you have great skills, so you can learn the rest."
After the CCTV announcement, the DCPA leapt into action. Kathy described the group as a clearinghouse for local Catholics who felt their needs weren't being met by the church hierarchy. This included black Catholics.
It was like an alternative diocese. What the diocese didn't do for the black churches, we did it. And of course it grew. In no time, we had 600, 700 people coming to meetings and coming up with all kinds of ideas about what we could do to get the diocese's attention.
In the period immediately after Shaka's announcement, Father Thomas and the DCPA organizers experienced
total chaos. And he'd say, let's start just putting a flyer out for a monthly meeting. Get it out to the churches. We always started with the parish, with the secretary and the pastor. Some of them didn't want any part of it. If the bishop says we have to do this, we're going to do it, period. And then you say, okay, thanks. If you ever feel like jumping in, here we are.
Kathy says city parishioners were dealing with a lot of emotions in those early months.
Fear, I think, would be the first thing. They felt totally out of control until we really started getting our chops and figuring out what we needed to do. They can just come in here and tell us we're no longer a church. In anger, that was predominantly what it was for a few months until we started to realize that we got to do something. You got to do something with that fear, and you have to do something with that anger. These churches are not all going to close. It's ridiculous. 56 churches in the city? I mean, it's everybody practically. Eventually, the mood did change as they were a little more hopeful that maybe we're really going to do something here.
Eric Blunt was another member of Sacred Heart. He started attending because of a woman he was dating. She kept talking about Father Thomas and the church. They eventually broke up, but Eric stayed.
I always admired Father Thomas from the pews, but once I became a minister, he kind of took me under his wing and started teaching me different things. More than anything else, you saw from his preaching and the way he lived that he was in and of the community, that he smelt like the people he was leading.
Father Thomas, who was of Lebanese descent, was sensitive to the fact that he was ministering to a mostly black congregation. Black cultural expressions were so central to the liturgies at Sacred Heart that sometimes the archdiocese called Father Thomas out.
Look, Norm, you're starting to act too much like the Baptist. Don't forget you're Catholic. He said, aren't the Baptists saving souls? What are we really here for? Are we here to prove that we're more Catholic than anybody else? But no, we're here to save souls.
When it came time to protest the planned closures, parishioners from Detroit's city churches showed up in force. Father Thomas and Sister Jolene spoke publicly about the archdiocese's actions during one television special. An interviewer asked Father Thomas about support for the DCPA.
Is your support universal among the parishioners?
Of the city parishes?
Yes, sir.
Oh, I think that 95% of the city parishioners are behind what we're doing. I haven't talked to the 5%, so I'm not... They may even be with us.
Hundreds of people from the affected churches participated in protest rallies. They signed petitions, prepared appeals, and even planned a lawsuit. Eric remembers the initial gathering at Sacred Heart.
I don't know if Father Thomas was just doing a mental exercise, but he was calculating off the top of his head what the capacity of the church was. Maybe he was gearing up to answer some of the media questions about how many people were there. I think he came up with a number like 800, and that would have been in the balcony too. It kind of gave you a sense of the civil rights struggle that you see with Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King. There was extreme frustration, but yet there was such electricity that we are coming together, and this power that we are creating is something no one could have anticipated or understood. I hate to use the cliche, but there was electricity in the air. It was an exciting time for the wrong reason.
There were still white people in city parishes, and anger over Shaka's plan did reach the suburbs too, specifically among those whose families had attended city churches earlier in the century. For many white suburban Catholics, these were ancestral homes as much as currently occupied ones.
I could sense people's anger turning into energy. Growing up in a black family, I didn't really see white people doing it like this. So it was like, these white people are mad and they're going to do something about this injustice. They realized we are in this crap together.
That's the voice of Eric Blunt, a Detroiter who's a parishioner at Sacred Heart Catholic Church. We've been listening to an extended excerpt from Aaron Roberts' podcast, The City and the Cross, from Commonweal Magazine. Head to Commonweal's website if you'd like to find all three episodes, or you can pick them up wherever you listen to podcasts. If you missed our interview with Aaron, it'll be posted in Stateside's podcast feed today. That's all for Stateside for now. I'm April Baer. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next time.